QSO Today, episode 488, Charles Powell, NK80. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on this week's show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. I want to thank my friend Israel Uri, 4X1MB, for renewing his annual sponsorship. 4X1MB was one of the very first sponsors of the QSO Today podcast, and I appreciate his support. Otherwise, my poor dog's bowl is empty, and we've had to reduce the heat in the cold of winter. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio? Do people still do that?" This podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. If you have agreed to be a QSO Today guest and just need to schedule with me, please reply to my invitations. Your story is important to this oral history of amateur radio, and I don't want to be a pest asking you for your reply. Besides, the QSO goes pretty fast, is often fun and interesting. Please reply today. Charles Powell, NK80, would argue that an early interest in radio and communications aided him in making a transition from professional French horn player to pediatric doctor, rather than suffer the midlife crisis. Charles likes just about everything that ham radio offers, including POTA, CW, kit building, old rigs, and operating his own de-expeditions from exotic locations around the world. NK80 and I discuss these topics and more in this QSO Today. NK80, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Charles?
4Z1UG, this is NK80, November Kilo 8 Oscar. Yes, I hear you loud and clear.
Charles, thanks for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Well, my actual licensure as a ham wasn't until later on, but I was a kid who at a very young age was interested in the light switch and would sit and, you know, the light would go on and I'd say, light, 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 light. My parents told me anyway. And I got into mischief with things like butter knives that went where they didn't belong. Always, you know, grew up around radio. I was interested in things like crystal sets. I made a crystal set with an old 1N34 diode with the glass case on it.
As the detector.
Yeah, could pick up a local radio station with that and had a little ferrite core that I think I ran through dental floss tube that was wrapped with wire. Didn't know what I was doing, but it worked. My dad got me a portable radio for the time. Now, remember, this was the 1950s. It had acorn tubes in it. And it was AM, FM, but, you know, I'd spend hours and hours listening to that, and I'd listen at night and listen to the distant stations coming in.
Well, now, I remember I had somebody on probably just last week who had a portable radio with the acorn tubes in it, and those radios actually had large batteries for the high voltage, right?
Yes, it did. It had actually three batteries in it, and one of them, you know, the big Burgess batteries, but one of them was, oh, I forget the voltage on it. It might have been 22.5. It might have been, I don't know, 47 volts or something like that. But yeah, it was quite a heavy thing when you got all the batteries put in it.
I received one of those from my grandfather in the 60s, because I'm a little bit younger than you are. And I took it to Sandy's Electronics in Canoga Park, which was at the end of the street where my grandparents lived. So I would spend hours there. I'm probably, I don't know, 10, 11. I take it to Sandy's Electronics, and the guy looks at it and he says, "Oh, it's going to cost the family jewels to put batteries in this thing."
Yeah. Yeah, they were not cheap. And they didn't last very long either, you know.
And they weren't rechargeable.
No, they were not.
It was a big deal to have batteries for those radios in those days.
Yes.
So what was the hometown, Charles?
Hometown was Akron, Ohio. I grew up in Akron, went to school there, finished high school there, went to a couple of universities, but did attend University of Akron for a little while.
Well, we can get there, but I just wanted to make sure that in the childhood journey, were you doing electronics? You had the radio. Did you proceed in electronics through those years? Did you have an interest in like high school or junior high school electronics courses?
Not so much in courses. There weren't courses available for that when I was, during junior high school and high school. But I built things. There were these little kits that General Electric put out that were like amplifier, was an intercom kit and little AM transmitter and things like that. And those were interesting kits because they were spring loaded. You put the leads of the components underneath these spring loaded hooks and put it together. And I played around with that intercom/amplifier for a long time. I at one point figured out that I could modify a flashlight, put a quarter inch jack in the bottom of it, and put a transformer between the output of the amplifier and the flashlight and modulate the flashlight and then listen to it at the other end with a small solar cell. So, it was things like that that always caught my imagination.
So you had wireless communications even then?
I did. And do you know that if you make a contact with light, it actually can count as an amateur radio contact?
Oh, is that right?
Yes, it is.
That's pretty amazing. In the license-free band?
In the license-free band, yes, indeed.
Your interest in technology and stuff, did that play a part in the choices that you made for your higher education? I mean, once you left high school?
Not directly. I didn't pursue electrical engineering or any kind of career in a technical field. But when it came to taking the exam, the medical college aptitude test, commonly known as the MCAT, all of the information I learned about antennas and resonant lengths and electrical formulas and Ohm's law and all of that put me through a whole semester of work in working toward taking the medical college aptitude test. And that was one of my highest scoring segments when I actually did take the test.
Just having this in your brain could potentially get you into medical school.
I wouldn't say it could get you into medical school, but I could definitely say that it's helpful in the material that you are expected to know, the general theory, physics. The areas, at least when I took the test, were physics, biochemistry, and English. And the physics area was basically a breeze.
I think that's great. You're not the first musician, by the way, that I've spoken to that's gone to medical school.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I find it so interesting that I've known some other musicians that have also transitioned from being professional musicians and end up going into medical school. Did your wife end up going to medical school and she's also a doctor?
Yes, my wife started medical school. I think I mentioned that she started at Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, and they closed the medical school, and she interviewed at University of Kansas, and she went to University of Kansas and completed her training. She's also a pediatrician, but she takes care of the kids who are more than nursery age, and I take care of the ones that are nursery age at this point. And we had a private practice.
So you worked together?
We did for a time, but, both of us, I won't say that that office work isn't challenging, but it's not what we were trained to do. When we trained, even though it was, you know, 20 some years ago, scary enough, I started medical school 30 years ago. The emphasis was still on critical care, hospital care, and not so much on outpatient. A lot of the training now is focused on outpatient care. But, you know, we were trained to take care of sick patients in the hospital. And we didn't, neither one of us found office work, aside from the hassles because we ran our own practice. Neither one of us found office work to be as challenging as we might have hoped. You know, a lot of administrative hassles and not a lot of rewards. And we ended up closing the practice because of insurance issues. The state of Kansas decided that they were going to change the providers that paid out the Medicaid claims in Kansas. And all of these big companies just didn't know how to, this just for your information, but all of these big companies just didn't know how to pay us. And, you know, I went for six months and said, I can't afford to keep subsidizing my employees. And they said, oh, we'll fix it. We'll fix it. And 2 months later, they were still, you know, saying, oh, yeah, we're going to fix it. And I said, yeah, except I'm done.
As a musician, you were a French horn player.
Yeah.
With an aspiration to play in a symphony?
Yes, symphony musician. And in fact, that's what my first career was, as a symphony musician.
And how was that career? I mean, I go to the Jerusalem Philharmonic. I see the French horn player sitting there in the middle. And I'm wondering, how can this guy make a living? And does he make a living playing all day long? Or is he falling back on his music education career in order to pull it all up?
You know, it's funny. That's a common question. I made a living as a professional musician. Now, I did not become wealthy by any means, but I paid all my bills and I paid them on time. And there was one point when I had kids that I delivered pizzas for a while, but that was, you know, sort of a summer job when things were slow with the orchestra. But I really did make my living for about 17 years that I made my living as a professional musician.
That actually meant that you showed up at the hall every day? Was that the kind of work this was? I mean, I have no idea what a professional musician does.
Yeah, usually there are rehearsals 3 to 4 days a week and then concerts 2 to 3 days a week. So, you know, depending on the concert, depending on the week, depending on what the literature is. You know, during the summer when I lived in Canada, we would go in the afternoon to Ontario Place and we would rehearse in the afternoon and play a concert in the evening. But for our regular symphony season, you know, it was a little more extensive than that.
And which symphony was it that you belonged to?
Well, there were several. My first job was in Johannesburg, South Africa. I played with the National Symphony Orchestra of the SABC, or in Afrikaans, die Nationale Symphonie Orkest van die SAUK.
In Afrikaans?
Yes, correct. Afrikaans. I learned a little bit of Afrikaans while I was there. And I worked there for 3 years. And then I went to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and spent some time freelancing there while I was looking for my next job. And had good success there. I made a lot of contacts very quickly and was able to get enough work to get by. And my next job was in the Hamilton Philharmonic Orchestra in Ontario, Canada, Hamilton, Ontario. And I spent 7 years at that job. And because my wife was looking to change careers at that time, we moved back to the U.S. I had found a job in the South Florida Symphony and worked in the South Florida Symphony for 2 years, I think. Fun living in South Florida, but hot, especially in the summertime. And my car didn't have air conditioning because it came from up north. But and then I my wife moved. She took a job in Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I didn't do very much while I was there. I actually did some singing and playing in bell choirs and things like that, and a lot of time taking care of the kids. Then we moved to from there to Tulsa, and I'm pretty convinced I would have had a job in Tulsa, except my wife was going to attend Oral Roberts University, which closed the year she started, so she was 6 weeks in, and they transferred everybody out. There's a long story behind that. But we moved to Kansas City area, and she went to medical school before I did. And I was working with the Kansas City Chamber Orchestra, Kansas City Camerata. There were various, you know, freelance gigs and things like that. But that was sort of the last of my musical career, because then I also applied for medical school in 1993 and started in the fall of 1993.
Really? That's quite a transition.
Yeah. Well, you know, I always joke that a lot of doctors are frustrated musicians, so I kind of turned the table, went the other way.
And how far did you go? Did you finish and become a resident and all that stuff?
Yeah, I am a medical doctor and still working 2 days a week. And the area that I went into was pediatrics. And in about 2006, I started working in neonatal intensive care. Now, I'm not a neonatologist, but I have lots and lots and lots of on-the-job training. And I've been working basically in neonatology since 2006 and exclusively since 2013.
Wow, that's an amazing transition. Can I ask you how old you were when you started medical school?
I started medical school at age 40. So when people tell me they're too old to do things, I scoff a little bit.
That's a huge commitment, right? Medical school might be, what, 4 years, and residence is like a 7 year project just to get to the point where you're a doctor?
Yeah, well, it's 4 years to become a doctor, 3 years to become somewhat competent as a doctor in residency training, and then you're sort of thrown to the wolves to go out and make a living somewhere.
What is the present QTH?
I live in a small town called Lewisburg, Kansas, which is south of Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, close to Overland Park and Olathe, Kansas.
You're working there as a doctor?
Yeah, I work currently working at five hospitals in the, well, I'm credentialed at five hospitals in the Kansas City area, and working in neonatal intensive care as a neonatal hospitalist. In other words, I'm the person who's in the hospital for 24 hours, and I have backup with a neonatologist. But, you know, when things happen, it's pretty much on me.
I have some experience. I have a granddaughter that was 2 months early. It's amazing the neonatology departments can do in terms of keeping it all together and keeping the families kind of calm at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of things that used to be life-threatening, you know, terrible ways to start life are now pretty routine. And the history of that is also interesting. I don't know whether you want to put this on the podcast or not, but the history is that in the early 1960s, John F. Kennedy had a son that was born prematurely, and he wasn't even born that prematurely by today's standards, but he had respiratory distress syndrome, what they used to call Hyaline membrane disease, and he actually did not survive. And John F. Kennedy was behind a lot of the money that went into research in neonatal intensive care in the United States.
Well, I have an identical twin, and we were both 2 months early in the 1950s. That was apparently an interesting time for my parents. I don't remember much of it. Together, our combined weight was half of what most full-term kids are. It was an intriguing period of time for my folks. Well, that's very interesting. So when does ham radio kind of enter the picture, and how do you find your way in?
Well, there are a couple of events that happened. When I was at the University of Cincinnati, there was a fellow that was maybe a year ahead of me at a university, but he ran the house radio station. We had an in-house, you know, closed circuit AM station that was called WGDI. Joel Frensdorf, Whiskey Alpha 8, Papa Alpha Golf, was the sort of general manager and enthusiast with that. And he was a ham radio operator. And he talked about being a ham, and it interested me. But of course, you know, I didn't pursue it at the time. But I did pursue my third class radio telephone license so that if the music thing didn't work out, you know, I'd be able to go work in a radio station for as a transmitter operator. And Joel showed me the station that they had up on top of the dormitory. It was a 14-floor dormitory, and then there were roof, I don't know, like booths, and the ham radio station was in there, and I remember being fascinated by that. And even earlier than that, you know, my dad had been a ham when he was younger. Now, he wasn't active at all when I was growing up, but he was a telephone man. And, you know, back on the electronics and things that interested me, you know, he would bring home a load of telephones that were taken out of service. And I would take them apart and take, you know, 20 telephones and make 12 working telephones out of them, you know.
And then he would tell you not to connect them to the lines.
More or less. But, you know, he was a telephone company employee. We had four or five phones in the house anyway, which was very unusual at the time.
And now this mid-show break. The future of podcasting and the QSO Today podcast is listener sponsorship. It keeps us lean and focused on providing you the best ham radio interviews since 2014. You can keep the QSO Today podcast commercial and sponsor-free by becoming a listener sponsor yourself. For $10 a month or save 20% at $100 per year, you can become a listener sponsor. I am now recording the QSO Today podcast as video interviews that are available only as a benefit to listener sponsors through our QSO Today community website. As I develop the sponsorship tier, I will add bonus content for listener sponsors. Listener sponsors, not donors, are automatically members of the new QSO Today Academy. I am building the Academy website to include access to our SQL I/O networking lounges all of the time and Academy resources, including over 400 previous expo presentations with Q&A and additional helpful ham radio educational resources. The benefit of listener sponsorship as an alternative to commercial sponsorship is that commercial sponsors influence the content and comments in the podcast. Listener sponsorship allows a greater degree of freedom to discuss any ham radio subject without commercial consequence. I have eliminated all commercials in the QSO Today podcast from episode 445, with the exception of the Ham Radio Workbench podcast, as I think that this is a serious asset to a well-rounded ham radio education. I am not using Buy Me a Coffee or Patreon, but my own system for managing the community that could form out of the podcast. I direct you to the sponsorship section of the show notes pages beginning with the episode 444, where I list all of the contributors to the podcast since 2014, including sponsors, donors, and hams who have paid for transcriptions. If sponsorship is not your interest, then you can make any size donation to the podcast by clicking on the donation button on the QSO Today podcast website at qsotoday.com. There is a slider that you can use to adjust the amount of your donation. If you want to make your donation monthly, click on the recurring donation box. It is the recurring donations and the listener sponsorships that keep the lights burning here. Finally, you don't have to contribute anything to listen to the QSO Today podcast. You can use my Amazon affiliate link before shopping at Amazon by clicking on it on the right side of the show notes page. This will signal Amazon to send us a small percentage of what you purchase. This is the most painless way to ensure that the QSO Today project will be here next week. I want to thank everyone who has contributed and will contribute to my effort to create this oral history of amateur radio since 2014. It will eventually all be in the public domain for hams in the future to enjoy. Be sure to become a listener sponsor or make a donation today. And now we return to our QSO Today. Now, my grandfather was a telephone company guy, career telephone company guy for his entire career. And he gave me, I was 8 years old, he gave me a telephone with a warning that I shouldn't hook it up.
Yeah, because they could measure the capacitance in the line and tell how many phones were connected.
Yes, they could, but, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you don't tell a kid that, you know, you don't give him the instruments and then tell him not to hook it up.
Yes, indeed.
Just out of curiosity, we go back to University of Cincinnati radio station. That was an AM carrier station, right? That was essentially they were injecting the signal into the electric lines of the dormitory.
Actually, we had wires that ran up and down the hallways every other floor for, you know, 14 floors. Yeah. So it was definitely a long wire antenna. But it didn't radiate outside the building much because, you know, it was a big steel building.
And did you have an audience, out of curiosity?
Oh, yeah, we did, yeah. And we used to play over the public address system in the dining room, which was attached to the dorm. Well, there were a dining room between two dormitories. So we had a pretty big audience. I helped redesign that station a little bit, clean up some of the wiring that was really, really messy, and make some additions to it.
So you got your third-class radio telephone license. What happened after that in terms of heading towards amateur radio?
Then the next year transferred to University of Akron and worked at their FM station, their on-air FM station, WAUP. And, you know, again, night DJ and transmitter operator. And they had, I think it was a 1,000-watt station, and they had three bays on the antenna or something like that. So, you know, the ERP was like 2.5 kilowatts or something like that. After that, it sort of went dormant for a while, except when I moved to South Africa, of course, you know, well, first of all, there was no TV when I moved there. So the transmitters hadn't gone online yet. And the only source of information you had was radio. And, because we didn't want to get our information from only one source, we used to listen to BBC and Voice of America and Deutsche Welle and... there were several others. Of course, you know, you could always pick up Radio Moscow, but I didn't spend a lot of time listening to Radio Moscow, but, it was there and, it was, an outside source. So we had some really interesting radios there. I had a radio that I took with me that was a Sony. It looked kind of like a lunchbox, worked very well. But when I was there, you know, there were a couple of us that were interested in radios, and that was, are you familiar with the Barlow Wadley radio?
No.
Okay. The Barlow Wadley radio was a unique design in that it had one dial to tune megahertz and one dial to tune kilohertz, and then a fine tuning that went with it. And, you know, basically you could dial in practically anything on the band very quickly. it wasn't a great design, but it was a curiosity for sure. And, you know, we used to spend, well, again, you know, in the evening I'd go home from work and I wouldn't have anything else to do. So I'd turn on the radio. And in the evening I'd generally listen to shortwave. That was also around the time that CB radios were popular, and I did spend a little time playing with CB radios as well. But when I really got my amateur license, I was 30 years old. I was living in Canada. So, you know, I didn't go the novice general class in the U.S. Route. I got my first license in Canada because a friend of mine that I had worked with in South Africa had gotten his, I don't know what they called it. I think they called it a Class B license in the UK. And he had gotten his Class B license in the UK. And he said, he sent me a letter and said, because, you know, there was no email then, and said, you should get your ham license. And I thought, gee, that sounds like a great idea. So I started investigating possibilities, and somebody at my church knew of the club in the area. They had a very active club, the Niagara Peninsula Amateur Radio Club, and some really, really outstanding folks who took teaching, you know, radio classes very seriously and were very good at it. And so there were two people who really stood out. And the first one was Arnold McBay, call sign Victor Echo 3 Lima Whiskey Whiskey at the time. He's now Victor Alpha 3 Lima Whiskey. And Arnold taught the theory portion of the class. And, you know, in Canada at the time, they were not multiple choice questions. They were write out the answer and hand it to the examiner. So you really did have to know basically what you were doing. And then my Morse instructor was Eric Stabler, now Silent Key, Victor Echo 3 India Sierra Delta. And Eric had an interesting background as well. He had been an interceptor stationed on Gibraltar that was intercepting the German code during World War II. And he was amazing. He could be standing in a room and listening to Morse code and then hear something that he wanted to follow. And he would slowly walk across the room, find a pencil and a piece of paper, an envelope or something like that, write like mad until he caught up with where they were sending, and then just casually continue writing while he carried on a conversation with you. Just an amazing Morse code operator. But Eric taught us Morse code, and there's a story behind that as well. Aside from the fact that he was an excellent operator, he was very dedicated to teaching the class. So he would sit down every week with his straight key and an oscillator and record our Morse code lessons on tape. And then he would duplicate the tape for everybody in the class. But Eric didn't spend a lot of time talking about speed or anything like that. He just said, you know, he'd say once, this is letter A, and he'd move on. And then he would send the letters that he was teaching that week. And each week he built on the letters using Farnsworth spacing initially, and he compressed everything together. But in Canada, the initial code speed was 10 words per minute. And he told me one day, I think I'd been in the class about 3 months. So the end of, we started in December, and by the end of March, he said, you're ready, go take your test. And I went to take the test, and I was horrified and terrified because it seems so slow to me after what he had taught us. that I was worried that I was going to make a lot of mistakes because these letters just took forever to go by. I literally thought that they had played back the exam at the wrong speed because it was, do you remember Wallensack tape recorders? Yeah. Well, the old Wallensack tape recorder could play at 3 3/4 or 7.5. And I thought they had played it back at the wrong speed. I thought it had been recorded at 7.5 and played back at 3 3/4. And I went back to Eric and I said, Eric, I passed, but it was so slow. I had no idea what was going on. And he said, oh, don't worry. I taught you at 20 words a minute. So, you know, of course, 10 words a minute seemed very slow to you. And he laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed. But he did set us up quite nicely to pass all of the subsequent tests. The advanced test in Canada was 15 words a minute. And, of course, the extra class test in the U.S. was 20 words a minute. So it was a few months after I got my I think I was on the air for 6 months so that I could get my 6-month endorsement for my basic license in Canada. And then I went and took the general test in the U.S. Passed that. And it was a few months after that that I took the extra class test and passed that. Do you remember the Dick Bash books?
No, I don't, actually.
Okay. Well, there was a time before the database of questions, the question pool was published. And there was a fellow named Dick Bash who spent time interviewing people as they left the exam saying, okay, what was on the exam? And wrote it all down. There was a big scandal about that. This was in the early 80s. There was a big scandal about this guy who was, you know, writing down all these question information, but he put together booklets that were very well written, very well organized, and essentially gave you everything you needed to pass the test, even though it didn't really give you all the answers. You know, it gave you all the information, told you what formulas you needed to know how to use and that sort of thing. When I took and of course, the fact that the U.S. tests were multiple choice, you know, it was pretty easy to pass. I'm not sure I could pass the extra class test off cold right now.
What was your first call sign?
First call sign was Victor Echo 3 Oscar Charlie Foxtrot, VE3OCF. And my first U.S. call was November 8, Foxtrot Romeo Zulu, N8FZR. No, Foxtrot Zulu Romeo.
And that was what, 1980?
Well, the 1983 was when I got my first Canadian license. And then also in 1983, I got my first U.S. license in the FCC office in Buffalo. Interesting side note, too, on my extra class test, the examiner stood up at the beginning of the test and he said, this is the last exam that we'll be giving at the FCC office. All subsequent tests will be administered through volunteer examiners. So I took the last test at the Buffalo office, last amateur radio test that was administered at the Buffalo FCC field office.
Wow, that's an interesting milestone. They didn't give you a certificate for that closing of the office.
No. They just made the announcement and that was it.
Well, everybody wants to be first, but you got to be last.
Yeah. He who is last shall be first. I don't know.
I guess there was a period of time that you became active. Did you have a first rig when you first got the license or you hadn't made the professional transition yet?
My first rig was a Yaesu FT-101EE, and the FT-101EE was sort of the economy model of the FT-101, and it didn't have, there were front-end filters that it lacked, that the FT-101E had. But, you know, it was a good radio, and I was very, very active for about 3 years. And again, because there were people who were very helpful and encouraged me, One of them was a very, very good friend of mine now, Silent Key. Victor Echo 3 Golf Mike Alpha, VE3 GMA. His name was Mario Cerluini. And Mario just, you know, really took me under his wing and got me on the air and encouraged me to operate and would, you know, call me up in the middle of the afternoon and say, get on the air. We need to do some code practice. And he would spend a lot of time just working with me. And not only that, I mean, he was a great friend. He would help me work on my car. And, you know, I mean, I was starving musician, you know, I needed help. So he would help me out with things. And he helped me put up my antennas when I first went on the air. And when I went to medical school, he told me he was determined to be my first patient. Unfortunately, he only lived a couple of years after that. I was not quite finished with medical school when he became a Silent Key. But he was just a great guy and, you know, took me around to the local Hamfest to buy a paddle. You know, I got a Vibraplex paddle that he helped me pick out. And he said, okay, you've been on the air long enough. You're allowed to buy a 2-meter radio. And an ICOM O2AT, the synthesized one with keypad, which I still have, incidentally, and it still works quite well, although the battery packs are all dead. But it does take an external power supply, and it does still work. There was Phil Anderson, VE3FAS, and I'm still in touch with Phil periodically. Phil was a traffic handler. And between Phil and my Morse mentor, Eric Stabler, they got me on the traffic nets for a while. So in that 3 years that I was active while I was still living in Canada, I got a lot of exposure to Morse code.
It seems to me that you took a little bit of a break from ham radio.
I did.
Was that because of medical school and the professional transition?
It was in part because of medical school, but it was also because, you know, again, my wife was, well, she had started out as a musician, and that's how we met. And she then became a nurse, but wanted to become a doctor. And so she was working on pre-med things long before I went to medical school. She was working on pre-med when we were still living in Canada. And she had applied to a medical school in Canada. It's a very reputable school, McMaster University. And, you know, I don't fault them at all for this, but they basically told her the only reason that you didn't get in is that you're an American citizen, not a Canadian citizen, and suggested that she apply to U.S. schools. At about the same time, I was offered a job in the South Florida Symphony, so I took that job. We moved back to the U.S. She continued her studies. She applied for St. John's University, which is on, what's the name of the island? Falkland Islands.
There's a medical school on the Falkland Islands?
Yes, there is. It's a pretty reputable school, too. I think most of the people that go there, they're people who don't get into U.S. schools, but, you know, it doesn't mean that it's not a good school. But when she interviewed for that position, the fellow who interviewed her, he said, look, your scores are high enough. You don't need to go here. So he said, I'll be happy to recommend you if you want to go here. But he said, wait a year, make applications elsewhere, go to a U.S. school.
Well, I can imagine that if you went to the Falkland Islands, you wouldn't have anything to do but study.
Exactly, yeah.
And do amateur radio, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's really hard to get a work permit to work there, so I probably would not have been able to work at all there. So and not much going on in the way of music there. So
that's actually a nice bit of trivia to know. I didn't think there was anything but a lighthouse in the Falkland Islands and a garrison of British soldiers.
There are several offshore universities in the Caribbean that, you know, some better than others.
Well, Falkland Islands is off of Argentina, right?
Yeah.
You might as well go to the South Pole.
Yeah.
You're almost there.
Something like that.
So you actually then took a break for a while and then you came back to ham radio?
Yeah. When we lived in Florida, I was active on 2 meters because I was involved in the hurricane watch nets, but not so much on HF. We were living in a condominium and, you know, I had like an indoor antenna, which picked up a lot of noise and didn't do very much. So it wasn't really very interesting to get on the air or try to get on the air. And after that, you know, my activity in amateur radio really dissolved until about 2011.
Because of the antenna situation?
Because of work and children and, you know, I have 4 children. As the children got older, it was harder and harder to find time to participate in radio. There were periods of time where I was basically a stay-at-home dad, you know, doing the shopping, doing the house cleaning and cooking and things like that. And kids take a lot of time.
Yeah, I have some experience.
Yeah, I kind of lost touch with the hobby, lost interest in the hobby. And in 2011, I was talking to my brother-in-law, who at the time had the call sign WA8CMU. He's now November 8 Alpha X-Ray. He finally upgraded to extra at my prodding. But he just mentioned to me, he said, we ought to get on the air and try to work each other. He's also a CW operator primarily. We started looking at, well, okay, what, you know, if we don't like this, if this isn't fun, how can we do this with a minimum of expenditure? I came across the Chinese-made radio that Pentek was selling. Yeah, they made an R4020 and an R4030. And I don't know why we decided on the R4030, but we got a pair of those and went on the air and actually did work each other a few times. But I think the thing that hooked me was, okay, I didn't have much of an antenna. I put an antenna that kind of went the span of my porch at where I'm living. I've been living here since 2001. I had this antenna that went under the eaves of the porch and I worked Central America with it. I can't remember which country, maybe. Which country it was, but it was, I remember it was a Central American country and this antenna is about, you know, 8 feet off the ground.
You were running QRP.
Yes. Yeah. Running QRP. And I thought, hey, this is fun. Interesting encounter. One of the first people in my log was K1VT, Jack. You know, Jack, you've interviewed.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I was just getting back into it, so I was struggling a little bit with copy, and I was still writing everything down at that time. But it stuck out in my mind, and when I met Jack later on DMR, I remembered that I had worked him because of his call sign. So that was an interesting chance encounter. I ended up putting up a little bit better antenna up between the trees, and I worked Mauritius with 5 watts on 30 meters. We certainly didn't rag chew, but we exchanged call signs and signal reports. So, and that was with that little Tentec radio. So I was hooked.
And you're living in an antenna restricted area. Is that why you're kind of being careful with the antennas?
No, it just, you know, again, it's one of those things I haven't quite got around to it. I'm in the area that I'm living, we don't have antenna restrictions per se, but they do have tower restrictions according to the city charter. And you're allowed to put up a 35-foot, you know, a 10-meter tower without a permit. Anything more than that, you have to do permits and basically show that the antenna will fall on your property if it falls down, which anything much taller than that would fall on my neighbor's property. I have 3/4 of an acre, but it's kind of a V-shaped lot. So it might be hard to put something really substantial up.
I saw that you have done some experimenting with magnetic loop antennas.
Yes, but primarily for portable work. I found that using the mag loop at the house, I still pick up a lot of noise. You know, there's just a lot of ambient noise here. But when I was working up in Nebraska, I was doing locum tenens work, you know, where you're hired to cover a particular hospital for a particular length of time. I actually worked up there for several years. But even before I started the Parks on the Air program and the World Wildlife Flora and Fauna programs, I spent a lot of time just going to parks because I was staying in a hotel. It was noisy. You know, you go to a park, there's no noise level. You can always find somebody to work, rag chew for a while, work a couple of different stations and pack up and go back to the hotel.
So you become a big POTA operator, right?
I have, yeah, both Parks on the Air and World Wildlife Flora and Fauna.
I see that you're a number one activator. What does that mean? In POTA jargon, what does a number one activator mean?
That was actually World Wildlife Flora and Fauna. But what that means is that I ventured out to more unique parks in 2023 than anybody else in North America.
Really? So it's the number and the type of parks that make that?
Number of unique parks. In other words, parks that you haven't been to that year.
I see. It's not unique by a park by definition. It's a wild animal park or it's a...
Yeah, there are several different kinds of parks for both programs. And a lot of them overlap, of course. There are state parks. There are national parks. There are national forests. There are national wildlife reserves. There are state conservation areas, you know, so it's a variety of types of areas that I've gone to. 2023 had a combination of just about everything, but I was traveling. I was in between late 2020 and early 2023, I was traveling to Alabama and working at a small hospital down in the southeast corner of the state in Dothan, Alabama. And during the pandemic, I just said, I'm done with flying. I'm not flying. So I would take 2 days to drive down there. And on the way, of course, as soon as you get south of, you know, Missouri, the weather's nicer. You can camp, stop at a park, take 2 hours out of your drive to, you know, take a side trip to a park, activate for a while, pack everything back in the car and go on your way.
So you were very deliberate about your route and what parks you would stop at when you were making these trips?
Yes, I would plan them out. I would look on the maps and say, hey, there's a park that's not too far off the road for me that I can visit, or a national trail or something like that. So out of the, I don't remember the exact numbers. I think there were something like, and of course, if I had a short time off between work, you know, let's say I worked typically 10 days in Alabama. But if I had 5 days off, I wouldn't drive home and then drive back. I would stay there, but I would go out and activate parks in Alabama. So there were maybe 100, and I don't remember the exact number, but there were like just shy of 200 parks in Alabama that were designated, and I went to almost 100 of them.
Charles, what makes a great POTA rig?
That's a loaded question. I have used a lot of different rigs. Initially, I was using a KX2 with a Hard Rock 50 amplifier, but it's not so much the rig as it is the antenna. My advice to anybody who's operating POTA or World Wildlife is forget about using horribly compromised antennas. You know, I have had very, very good success using a full-length vertical on 20, 17, 15, 12, 10. And of course, you know, a telescoping antenna, you can adjust it so that you don't even really need a tuner for it. I have had my best success using that vertical on those upper bands. And then on 30 and 40 meters, using just like an inverted V, but again, a full-length antenna. You know, I see lots of guys and they're using the loaded antennas. And, you know, don't get me wrong. I've used loaded antennas when you can't use anything else. I have some Shark helically wound antennas that I use on a mag mount on the car. But I've never tried those QRP. I was using power with that. But anyway, I progressed from the KX2 with an amplifier to a Yaesu FT991A because it's basically a shack in a box. And this year, my decision was that I was going to make all of my activations QRP. So I've been out five times in 2024, and I've used five different radios for my activations. So I started out with a KX3, a K2, a KX2, a Pentek TR45L, and the last one was with a Zygu G90. And of course, you know, you can talk about the merits of each one of the radios, but let me just say my Elecraft radios are my favorites.
Obviously, the KX2 is brilliant because of its size and capability and stuff, but what do you think of the K2 still as a POTA radio?
It's an extremely capable radio. Now, mine is only set up for CW. I never put the single sideband, and I never put the amplifier module in it. Mine is strictly CW. But, you know, it did its job, and it did it well. The goals for POTA and World Wildlife are different. So the goal for POTA is to get 10 or more contacts. The goal for World Wildlife is to get 44 or more contacts.
In the same spot?
Yeah, in the same spot.
In that park?
Correct. Well, I have not had less than 48 in the log in my five QRP activations yet. And I haven't spent, you know, all day there. I haven't spent more than about 90 minutes at a park to get those. And sometimes I've spent less than an hour getting, you know, 50 or so in the log. But again, I think, you know, my recommendation to anybody who's doing activations is use a full-size antenna. Use a full-size antenna because that's the secret to really getting people to hear you.
So do you have some bumper mount or something like that for the mast of this vertical that you use?
The vertical that I'm using currently is something that I got from AliExpress. It's a Chinese-made antenna, and it has a ground pin to put into the ground. It has ribbon cable that it uses as radials. Now, there's just four of them, but each one of those four has eight conductors on it, and I think that it really does function more efficiently with those ribbon cables than it would with just four pieces of wire on the ground. And then the telescoping whip just sits on top of that. You know, it's almost fully extended for 20 meters. I take in three segments for 17 meters, six segments for 15 meters, etc. you know, and I pretty much know where it's going to be for each band.
So you tune it, you hand tune it with an SWR meter or bridge or something like that. You're not using an internal tuner in the radio?
No, I usually bypass the internal tuner in the radio.
Of the rigs that you just mentioned, which was your favorite to operate?
Well, definitely the Elecraft radios are my favorite to operate. They have the, you know, silky smooth gears and great filtering. And again, it depends on what you're doing. If you're doing something out of the trunk of the car and setting up on a table, it doesn't matter how heavy the radio is. So, you know, I like using the KX3 with the pan adapter with it. But, you know, if I want to just set up in a hurry and be able to set up anywhere, the KX2 is basically the perfect radio for that.
I want to take a minute to tell you about my favorite podcast, the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast, with George, KJ6VU, and now joined by Rod, VA3ON, Mike, VA3MW, Mark, N6MTS, and Vince, VE6LK. Every 2 weeks, George and company offer up a status report on the many amateur radio projects on their workbenches and explore projects on their guests' workbenches. This group is project active and prolific, covering many technical areas of amateur radio. So the next time you want a deep dive into ham radio electronic project building, or to learn about technology, tools, test equipment, construction techniques, and the rest, listen to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast, available on every podcast player and channel. Use the link in this week's show notes page to get to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast directly. And now back to my QSO. It's my understanding that you're doing a lot of kit building right now, because you have a lot of pictures on your QRZ page of things that you're building.
Yeah, I've built quite a few things. I've had a few failures, too. Currently on the workbench is a NorCal 40B that was redesigned by Dave Kripe.
Sure.
I've got it together. I've got it receiving. It's not transmitting. I think I've narrowed down the problem. I think there's a problem. I think the mixer chip is bad, because that radio has an interesting way of generating the transmit frequency. Instead of having an oscillator that is set to the transmit frequency, it uses the local oscillator and mixes it with a crystal signal to generate the transmit frequency. Well, I've got everything right up to the mixer, and all of the correct frequencies and all of the correct findings there. But on the other side of the mixer, I got nothing out. And when Dave initially issued the kit, he then posted that we have some bad mixer chips, and I replaced them. But I think I still got a bad one that went in, and I haven't gotten back to it yet to pull that chip out or to do any experimentation to see if I can get it to transmit a signal by injecting a signal, you know, on the other side of the mixer.
Well, I'm very glad that Dave has pursued the NorCal 40B. I remember 4 days in May, a couple of years ago, there were some guys that were presenting using the NorCal 40B to teach an electronics course in college. And there's actually a textbook that goes along with it. So they were lamenting the fact that getting the NorCal 40B kits was becoming a problem. So it's nice to see that Dave decided to, apparently must have gotten permission from Wayne Burdick, N6KR, to actually reproduce the kit. So I think it's a magnificent project for somebody that wants to learn everything there is to know about radio.
Yeah, it's it's a rather involved textbook. I've read the Reader's Digest version that Dave published with his instructions. You know, he put the basic theory behind the radio. But just having that, I was able to figure out at least where the problem is, if not fix the problem quite yet.
Do you have test equipment on your test bench?
I have an oscilloscope on my test bench, which I found very useful. Of course, I've got a Fluke multimeter. You know, I don't have a lot of things. I have a spectrum analyzer. I've got one of the tiny SAs that I haven't used yet. It's still sitting in a box, and I need to get it out of the box and play with it a little bit. But yeah, and I've got, you know, I've got various things that I've made. I've got a some antenna analyzers, some dummy loads, and
well, and you've got a bunch of rigs that, if in the worst case, if you wanted to hear the signal, you could turn on one of the other rigs.
Yeah, exactly, and that's often what I do. One of the most fun radios that I built was a design by Dave Benson, K1SWL, for the four-state KORP club. He redesigned one of his radios, and it's called the Hilltopper. And the Hilltopper is a very, very basic radio, but works unbelievably well for what it is. If you look on my QRZ page, you'll see that somebody made a modification for that radio that allows it to have a display and show, you know, whether you have the receiver incremental tuning on. And it actually will work with cat control. So if I have it hooked up to my logging program and I want to change frequency, I can just type the frequency in and hit enter, and it changes the frequency in the radio.
I remember these radios are ideal for if you're a backpacker. So if you're doing soda, for example, you can put that in the backpack and you're not carrying too much weight.
Yeah, they're very lightweight, and, you know, they're monoband radios, but, you know, soda guys, some of them are very ambitious, but a lot of guys go out and make their four contacts, and they're, you know, whatever comes after that is fine. But, you know, they're interested in getting those first four because that's how they get credit for the activation.
Yeah, I get that. Are you a Linux user?
I am, yes.
Well, so am I. I always like to shout out to a fellow Linux user. What brand of Linux do you use?
Well, currently I'm using Zubuntu. That's one of the variants that instead of having the stock graphical user interface, it's using the XCFE4 interface, which is lighter weight, a little more flexible, and you can make it look basically exactly the way you want it to look. And I find that it's very, very useful. But, you know, for example, right now, my laptop that I use for all my portable activations is the one that has my logging program. And that laptop is sitting upstairs on a chair right now. But on my main screen downstairs, I'm displaying that log right in front of me. So, and the cat control for my main rig, which is a K4D, is connected to that. And of course, the program that I'm using is called CQR Log. And CQR Log now has profiles. So you can select K4, IC7100, the FT991, you know, and you just click down and it will connect to whatever radio is connected. But, you know, being a Linux user, I challenge anybody using Windows to be able to do this. I do remote work, and I have an IC7100 and the remote rig pair of boxes that goes with it. So the RF deck is in my shack, and the control head goes with me. So if I'm working in a hospital, you know, I'm not busy 24 hours a day. I have time off. And when I travel, if I'm staying in a hotel, I can set this up and I can use my home station. But with the RF deck sitting in my shack, I can tunnel to the computer it's connected to, forward the port to my laptop, and display on my logging program frequency, change band, all of the things that I would be able to do if that radio were connected directly to my laptop. And there's no physical connection to the laptop at all.
You have the K4. Does the IC7100 precede the K4 in terms of thinking about using it for remote control? Doesn't the K4 have like IP connections now?
The K4 has IP connections, but the implementation has not been released to the public yet. I guess they've made it work. You can use two K4s to control. You can use, well, unfortunately, it's a Windows program to control a K4. But none of that software, to my knowledge, has been released for public use yet.
I understand. I use Kubuntu Linux, and the reason I became a Linux user is because I didn't like my interface changing every time I went to bed.
or it updating every time you go to bed.
There's so much conversation going on between Microsoft Windows 10 and 11 to the outside world while I was sleeping. I was wondering who was using my computer.
It's a lot of bandwidth that they take up. The thing about this is I can update my software and it doesn't change my interface at all. And not only that, last time I booted the one of the computers that I have that has Windows on a separate partition, it took 45 minutes for it to update. I swear it was at least 45 minutes to update. Whereas with the Ubuntu variants, you know, you click update, it'll do most of it in the background. It might or might not ask you to reboot the computer.
Right, or it'll hold everything off until you do reboot it.
Yeah, say I'm busy right now, don't reboot. It will not force you to do that.
We shouldn't be Linux snobs, Charles, because I realize that most people listening to us are probably suffering with Windows even still. I do IT support for a living, and I can tell you that every time Microsoft changes the interface and it updates to a new version of something in the middle of the night, it becomes a whole day's worth of work for me. Because people are saying, hey, I'm missing my whatever, or these buttons aren't where they were before.
Yeah. The cool thing about Linux is that, you know, again, my station control program runs on a Raspberry Pi that sits in my shack. But I can pull that panel up. It's, you know, it's a little toolbar at the top of the screen. I can pull that toolbar up as long as I've got an internet connection. Any place in the world, I can pull that control up, operate my remote station.
You have a number of countries that you've worked from. It looks like you go on de-expeditions. You went to Tanzania, for example. You've been to the Caribbean.
Yeah. I've been to Tanzania, I think, 9 times now.
Really?
Yeah. I'm involved in a humanitarian project there that we've been building hospitals and providing medical services. Unfortunately, a lot of my work has been administrative in that, not hands-on. I've had some hands-on work. But in going there, the second time I went, I got the call sign 5 Hotel 9 Charlie Papa, which, you know, were my initials, Charlie Papa. And when I moved, we moved our operation, moved on to a new operation in a different part of the country. And my call sign would have changed to 5 Hotel 3. Well, when I was getting that call sign, I was working with a local amateur who is, he's a trustee of the Tanzanian Amateur Radio Club. And he's basically one contact who interfaces with government to get licenses, you know, because unless you're there, it's pretty hard to do. And you really do want to have your license in place before you go. So I was emailing back and forth, and I said, Heaton, how about the call sign 5 Hotel 3 Delta X-ray? I see that no one's had that before. He said, yeah, we should be able to get that. So when I got it, I've kept it up and, you know, done that for several years. Yeah, I've had it since, I think, 2014 now. So I've had it almost 10 years now.
And the rig you take with you when you go there?
I actually have a rig that's sitting in a small container that stays there, which is a KX3 and a KXPA100. It was my original KX3 that incidentally has serial number 73. Good number for a ham to have. So far, so good. I've had it in a container with drying agent because it's very humid there and humidity will take a radio out pretty quickly. So far, so good. I haven't been back since 2020 with the pandemic.
Do you have plans to go?
Tentatively, I might go in June this year. But, you know, I've always operated holiday style, although I do have about 15,000 contacts in the log. Most of those from 2020 when I got stuck, couldn't fly back, no flights out. So, you know, what else was there to do but play radio?
Is the internet connection from there good enough to actually use your remote rig?
At certain times of the day, because most of the internet connections are through cellular hotspots.
That makes sense.
Yeah, those will work. But, you know, when the system is loaded down, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, forget it. It's not going to work.
What excites you the most about what's happening in amateur radio now?
I would say the variety of opportunities that are available for operators to explore. Even though I'm somewhat of a curmudgeon CW operator, I've had some fun operating FT8 and FT4. I really like FT4. I'm really surprised that it isn't used more often because sometimes, you know, FT8 is compared to watching paint dry. FT4 is twice as fast and, you know, it's not quite so tedious to operate. But the digital modes excite me. I think the removal of the symbol rate limit by the FCC is going to spark some new innovation in communication and amateur radio. Obviously, the parks programs excite me a lot because they have. I think that those programs have done more to reinvigorate amateur radio than just about anything over the last two decades, at least, because it's bringing operators in. It's getting people interested in working Morse code again. You know, I think you've had experience with the CW Ops class. You know, people are going to those classes so they can go activate parks and use CW and use a 5-watt rig instead of carrying around a big, heavy, you know, single sideband rig that needs to be, it's not exactly backpack friendly.
Well, I think that these small rigs also have made it possible for people to go out. I think you're right that Parks on the Air has also been able, for people that are stuck in homeowners associations,
yeah,
HOAs, it's a life changer if you're a ham in an HOA.
Yeah, that and the proliferation of remote operation and the availability of inexpensive radios. If you compare, for example, the HW8, if you look up behind me, you'll see one on the shelf. If you compare that radio and the cost when it came out, in today's dollars, it was, I don't know, $750, maybe $800.
Right. It was expensive.
It was very expensive.
And it was crappy.
Yeah.
At the time.
I just got one because I thought it was a cool looking radio and I wanted one. But it's been on the air a couple of times, but not that much.
Are you that much of a purist that you wouldn't like maybe redo the inside? Put the Wayne Burdick radio inside there?
I might. I might.
With the NorCal 40, put it in the HW8 case.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, the inexpensive radios, I mean, these, you know, sub $100 radios that you can get from QRP Labs. And, you know, here's QRP Labs issuing a radio now that I think soon will have not only CW and digital capabilities, but also is going to have single sideband capabilities. You know, the little QMX that...
That's right.
Yeah, the little QMX, I think, is going to really take over the market if that radio gets single sideband added to it. And, you know, there are a lot of guys who modified the QCXs with the custom firmware to do single sideband. I haven't done any experimenting with that. But I've had a lot of fun with my little QDX, which is the digital radio. I actually did a review of that radio. I wasn't sure how they got my name, but kind of out of the blue, the fellow who does manages the reviews for QST asked me if I would review it because he saw that I had written some things about it on Facebook. And so I went ahead and wrote a review and they published it. But, you know, that's a fun little radio, and it's amazing radio to use. It's probably the closest thing to a plug and play digital radio that I've ever experienced. There's very little setup to it. You know, you basically plug it in.
Can you power it from the USB port, or do you need a little bit of external power in order to make that?
You need a little bit of external power, but, you know, now you can get these rechargeable AA batteries, and you can get a pack, little battery pack from Amazon that puts out exactly the 12 volts that it wants. And, you know, you got this little pack and you're on the air.
What advice would you give to newer returning hams?
I think a lot along the same lines that a lot of your folks have given, and that's try a lot of different things, number one. And number two, find somebody to help you with it. You know, a lot of my help with things has not been local, but, you know, getting on DMR, I've been able to talk to, you know, George, KJ6VU. There was a fellow that, unfortunately, I've lost track of him right now, but Bernie, fellow out in California that works for Red Cross, used to get on regularly. And, you know, he was one of these intuitive guys. He said, well, you know, this is how you get into that. And I'd say, oh, okay. Unfortunately, there's a silent key. He was a great guy, Mike W8NWA. Frequently on DMR, and, you know, I'd say, hey, Mike, I'm having a problem with this or that or something else. And, you know, he was a electrical engineer, had decades and decades of experience with RF circuits, and he'd just, you know, he'd spend as long as it would take to explain. I've talked with Jack K1VT on DMR. Jack is a he's an encyclopedic knowledge about electronics, you know. Another fellow, John AA7US, you know, John's a great guy, and he's, you know, he's a lot like me. He's just an experimenter. He's not an electrical engineer, but he's had experience with things. So my advice would be find people you can talk to who can help you out with snags that you run into. If you run into a brick wall, there's a solution. You just need to find somebody to help you get past that.
Charles, this is such a pleasure. I know it's been a long time coming in terms of organizing and getting it together, but I'm so grateful that you decided to come on the QSO Today podcast. I'm so glad we did it. With that, I want to wish you 73 and thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Charles. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put an NK80 in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some of the episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, please contact me. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing on the subscribe buttons on the show notes page. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. Use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on what you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform, including Spotify and the iTunes Store. Until next time, this is Eric 4Z1UG 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.